Morning. This morning I'd like to present a lesson that I was listening to recently, part of a series of lessons that take concepts that we know of in the Bible and they trace it kind of throughout the entire Old Testament into the prophets and into the New Testament. And the one that really appealed to me that I wanted to present to you is on holiness. The idea of what does it mean to be holy? How is holiness, that concept, used throughout the Bible? And, you know, if you've been part of church for a long time, you say holiness, you know, you think separated for a purpose, it has a specific purpose to it. We have that definition kind of coded in. If not, surely you've heard about the songs, right? We sing them in our hymns a lot of times. Even your Bible printed on the front says Holy Bible. It's a word that we're familiar with. But the question that I want to talk about this morning is kind of like, how is that concept used throughout the Bible? So we're going to start here in the first time that we find it used, and that's in Exodus, the third chapter. And so I think a lot of these will be familiar to us, but in Exodus, the third chapter, is the incident of the burning bush. You know, things that we don't frequently talk about up here, but teach our children all the time, right? The burning bush. So it might be something we haven't thought of in a while. In Exodus, the third chapter, and starting in verse 1 there, and just for a little context, this is after Moses has left Egypt. He's all grown up now, and now he's a shepherd, right, living with the Midianites. It says there, Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. And then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And so here's where we kind of see this first notion of holy. The ground around this burning bush, this representation of God, was holy. And there was an aspect of it that Moses was not permitted to come any closer. And he was supposed to take off his shoes. And now it doesn't really explain to us why, but he had to take off his shoes, whether or not it was some kind of, I don't know why, right? But I'm not sure. But there was something that about it that Moses could not come any closer to the presence of God. And we also know from the text there that Moses feared for his life. He was afraid. He hid his face, right? Because he could not behold, because there was something there that was kind of dangerous and terrifying. And I think like that's maybe the first image that we get, really, this notion of holiness. And I kind of think of it like comparing God maybe to the sun. If you think about the sun is absolutely essential for life on our planet. We take its warmth, without it we would freeze, right? And take the energy that it transmits to us, and plants convert that into food that other animals eat. We would not exist without the sun. It is absolutely critical. But get too close to it and it's dangerous. I need not tell you in this Tennessee summer, right? In this case, we're not any closer to it. We're just the angle of the sun is a little bit more direct, and it's almost unbearable, right? And later on, it'll be kind of, we're not that much closer or not to the sun. And we can't even get close to the sun, right? Because we'll burn up. Does it make the sun bad or evil? No, but the sun is so powerful and unique in our solar system, right, that it bears some respect. And I think that maybe that idea really applies here when we try to understand the notion of God and his holiness. He is good. He is essential for life on this planet. He's the cause of all life on this planet, on this universe, the whole creation. But coming near to him as we are in impure beings is dangerous, and we can't do that. And that's a concept that's carried through in throughout as God gives law to his people. You remember Leviticus? We studied this a few years ago. But Leviticus, the whole chapters 11 through 17 are just chock full of regulations, of things that made the people impure, because the people were supposed to live in proximity to God. Right? God was going to dwell in the Ark of the Covenant. right? And that Ark of the Covenant was going to be in the tabernacle, and the people were going to live around that. And so they were to be holy, like, because they were to be in close contact with him. And so we read all these regulations, right, about animals that you were supposed to touch or not touch or eat or can't eat. And a lot of those regulations, they had to do with touching things that were dead. If you touched something that was dead, you were impure. If you touched blood or other types of human emissions, bodily emissions, that also made you impure. And you had to then purify yourself because they were living in the presence of God. You can see that kind of represented here in Leviticus, the 11th chapter. Verse 43, he's talking here about a list of things that the animals that they were supposed to keep away from. And here he's kind of ending it on swarming things, things like locusts and insects. In verse 43 of Leviticus 11, he says, "You shall not make for yourselves detestable with any swarming thing that swarms. You shall not defile yourselves with them and become unclean through them. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy." Why are we holy? We're holy because God is holy. Right? And that implies that we have to live our lives in a different way. They had to live their life in a different way. Right? In this case, avoiding these types of insects. "You shall not defile yourself with any swarming thing that crawls on the ground, for I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God, and you shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." And so this concept of holiness is this wonderful, powerful thing that the defiled cannot get close to. It continues, right? Because if you read in Leviticus, the 16th chapter, we read about the priests, right? And specifically, the Day of Atonement, what happened on the Day of Atonement. Leviticus, the 16th chapter, starting there in verse 1, said, "The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron. And when they drew near before the Lord, they drew near before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Tell Aaron your brother not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil.'" So this kind of set for this order. If you remember, like the tabernacle area itself is for priests. Inside that building was for priests. But inside the holiest place, that place where the Ark of the Covenant was, he's saying, don't just come at any time. You can't just come in there as you please, right? That's a special place. So what does he say about that? He said, "Tell Aaron your brother," in verse 2 there, "not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that is on the ark, so that he may not die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat." So he gives very clear reason why. It was a dangerous, dangerous thing to be an impure person and come into the presence of holiness. So what was the fix? Verse 3, "But in this way Aaron shall come into the holy place. With a bull from the herd, a sin offering, and a ram for a burnt offering, he shall put on the holy linen coat. He shall have the linen undergarment on his body, and he shall tie the linen sash around his waist. He shall wear the linen turban. These are holy garments. He shall bathe his body in water and then put them on, and he shall take from the congregation of the people of Israel 2 male goats for sin offering." And then he keeps on talking about what it is that he is supposed to do. But notice that Aaron is allowed to come into this holiness, but only under like very specific circumstances. He's got to purify himself by the way that God told him to purify himself to be able to come into that presence. And that's kind of a notion that we take about holiness, and it kind of carries through. So the temple, the tabernacle, these were holy, sacred places. Most Israelites never saw them ever in their entire lives, right? Just the priests, and in the holiest of holies, the high priest, and only once a year. And that's just the way, that is the notion, really, of holiness that a Jew would have grown up with. So let's skip forward now, about 600 years, and go and read part of the prophecy from Isaiah. Because this image of holiness, I think, pretty much continues like this for a long time, until we come to Isaiah, the 6th chapter, and something peculiar happens. In Isaiah, the 6th chapter, and starting in verse 1, we're going to read about a dream that Isaiah has. It says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple." Okay, so for starters, he is in the temple. Isaiah is in the temple. Above him stood two seraphim. Each had six wings. Two he covered his face, two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. So I point out that this vision that Isaiah is having is peculiar for a lot of reasons, but Isaiah is having this vision, and he's not where he's supposed to be. He is in the house of the Lord. He is before the throne. He is there in that holy place. And he is experiencing and seeing this image of God right here before him. And so what is his reaction? Well, let's keep reading. He says in verse 5, "And I said, 'Woe is me, for I am lost, a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King and the Lord of hosts.'" You see, he has that old concept of holiness, right? That he is unclean, he realizes he's unclean, and here he finds himself in the presence of holiness, and he knows he's lost at that point. And let's see what happens in verse 6. "Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he has taken with the tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth and said," now look at what he says, "'Behold, this has touched your lips, and your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for.'" And what this is kind of a reversal, right? Because the way that cleanness worked was, whenever you touched something that was unclean, it made you unclean, right? And then there's a procedure that you would go through to make yourself clean again. But here we see kind of the opposite happening, that something comes from the Lord and touches Isaiah, and it makes him clean, right? Which is backwards. It doesn't work like that normally. We're offered no explanation of this. This is just something that happens here. And so we kind of scratch our heads at that. But there's another instance, I think, that sheds some light on this in Ezekiel, the 47th chapter, another vision that we read about. And again, it's of the temple. This time it's Ezekiel. This is during the time of exile, right? Like after the Israel's gone and Judah has been taken into captivity during this time, or is about to. In Ezekiel 47, we're kind of interrupting this vision that he had. It says, "Then he brought me to the back door of the temple, and behold, water was issuing from below the threshold of the temple toward the east." Okay, so we're back at the temple. Remember, the temple is this image of holiness, right? Of the presence of God, the place that you weren't supposed to go to because you were unclean and impure. And the vision again takes him back to that temple. And in this case, it looks like the temple has a leaky faucet because there's water coming out of the temple. It says there that the water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. Verse 2, "Then he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me around on the outside of the outer gate that faces east, and behold, the water was trickling out on the south side." And as he keeps on looking and he keeps on moving, the water that's coming out of the temple is getting deeper and deeper. First it's ankle deep, then it's knee deep, then it's waist deep. It's turning into a river, right, that's issuing from this temple. Then down in verse 6, he said to me, "Son of man, have you seen this?" And then he led me back on the bank of the river, and as I went back, I saw on the bank of the river very many trees on the one side and the other. And he said to me, "The water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah and enters the sea. Where the water flows into the sea, the water will become fresh." So if you remember your geography a little bit, east of the temple of Jerusalem is the Dead Sea. And we call it the Dead Sea for a reason. It's because there's nothing in there that can possibly live. It's so salty that you can't really sink in it. You float. You have to be really careful, like not to get it in your eyes or something, because it's really saturated with salt. It's dead, right? And it was then too. And so he says, like, look at what's happening. This water is flowing, but what happens when the water flows into this dead part of the sea? It says that the water becomes fresh, right? And in verse 9, "Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live, and there will be very many fish. And then down below, verse 12, he says, "And on the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruits fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food and their leaves for healing." And what an opposite kind of idea of this. On the one hand, you have the idea of this temple as this unapproachable place, right? And what Ezekiel, the picture that Ezekiel paints now is that this image that he sees is that this water is going to issue forth and provide life, right? Something is coming out of the temple now and providing life to the people that are around it. Again, I think that at the time they would have really scratched their heads because this is really contrary to their notion of what the temple was and what holiness was. So fast forward now into the New Testament, and how do we see this notion of holiness in the temple being used there, this idea of purity and impurity? In the Gospels, we see a whole lot about that, actually. And it makes a lot of reference to it, but if you're not paying close attention, it's easy to miss it. So if you look at Matthew, the 8th chapter, for example, this is right after the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew, the chapter 8, he writes here, "When he came down from the mountain," that is, he being Jesus and the mountain being where he was teaching the Sermon on the Mount, "the crowds followed him. And behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him and said, 'Lord, if you will, you can make me clean.' And Jesus stretched out his hands and touched him, saying, 'I will, be clean.'" It's really easy for us to kind of not understand the significance of that. But one of the things that made you unclean and impure was touching somebody that had some kind of skin disease. You didn't touch lepers because that made you unclean. Also, it was there was a chance of the spread of the disease. But more than that, you just didn't do that because it made you unclean. And here you see Jesus touching the leper, but it doesn't make him unclean. Jesus touches the leper and it makes the leper clean, right? It's reverse. In some sense, Jesus is like that coal, right, that the seraphim took and pressed it to Isaiah's lips, making Isaiah clean. Jesus touches him and makes him clean. And so we see this, if you start to think about that, you'll notice that the Gospels mention quite frequently that Jesus touches people, very, very specifically that he touches them. And we can read about another one in Mark, the 7th chapter. Again, but you can find these all over. In Mark, the 7th chapter, in verse 33, or verse 32, rather, it says, "They brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears. And after spitting, touched his tongue. And he looked up to heaven and sighed and said to him, 'Ephphatha,' that is, 'Be open.' And his ears were opened, and his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly." Again, touch, right? Jesus, with his touch, really took the impurity away from him. He should have made him unclean, but rather the opposite was true, right? Jesus made him clean. And another one in Luke, and this one maybe is the one that you had in mind when we started talking about this, Luke, the 8th chapter. And in this case, Jesus is in a crowd. You can imagine after Jesus started healing. I mean, even by today's standard, there's a lot of people in the hospital with diseases that are incurable. And even with modern medicine, if there was somebody who was healing stuff that was uncurable, that would be a very popular guy. Jesus was a very, very popular person because he went around healing. And in Luke, the 8th chapter, in the middle of there, verse 42, it says, As Jesus went, the people pressed around him. I don't know if you've ever been in a narrow, busy street before where there's just no room. I mean, no room whatsoever. That's what I picture when I read this verse. He says, "There was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone." I want you to think about that. The woman had this discharge for 12 years. And if I understand the law correctly, that meant that she was impure for 12 years. She was ceremonially unclean that entire time. She had no recourse. And she came up behind him and touched him in the fringe of his garment. And immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, who is it that touched me? Right? And you can imagine the apostles were like, what are you talking about, Jesus? Like, when all denied it, Peter said, Master, the crowds are all around you. They surround you and pressing in on you. But Jesus said, someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me. And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. But again, this reverse. Jesus is this holy coal that whenever he touched the other people, he made them holy. Their impurity did not translate to him. In terms of this vision of the water flowing as well, I think we have some examples of that too. And especially in John the fourth chapter, you might remember that as the Samaritan woman at the well. In John the fourth chapter, you remember that he has this discussion with this Samaritan woman, but we'll pick up the discussion in verse 13. Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. She's talking about the water of the well. And we all know that. You get a drink of water, hour goes by, you need another one. That's what Jesus is saying. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. Now this starts to sound a whole lot like that vision that we were reading about of Ezekiel. And the idea that holiness not only being that it makes others holy as it touches them, but actually goes, springs out and brings life to those who are around it, rather than being that inapproachable, right? That inapproachable thing that we can't come near because of our defilement. We read it also about it. He also makes a similar statement in the seventh chapter. And in the seventh chapter, Jesus is in Jerusalem for one of the feasts. So there's a lot of people there at this time. It says in John the seventh chapter, verse 37, on the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. And so he describes this kind of holiness that actually will also become part of us, right? That if we believe on him, out of us springs forth that same water that will become life to those around us. Not because of us, right? But because of God in us. And we see that same concept carried through even into the very end of the Bible in Revelation, the 22nd chapter. You remember the New Jerusalem that's described. But read with me the first few verses of Revelation 22. It says, the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city, and either side of the river, the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree were healing for the nations. This same notion, right? About holiness being something that not only do we approach, and not only does it cleanse us, right, but flows out and provides us life. So I found that idea really interesting, just not something that I had really ever thought about. The other concept of holiness, I think we get really well, right? And I think that a lot of us, as we strive to be holy as God is holy, we try very difficult, as we were discussing in class today, to put to death in our members the things that make us impure. And to, at times, maybe build up a wall around us, right? to keep that uncleanness at arm's length. And that's exactly what the Jews of the first century did, right? The ancient Jews, they had a word for you if you were not a Jew. Can you imagine? Like, what if we had a word for everybody that wasn't, you know, a Christian, non-Christians? But, I mean, they had a specific word to refer to that. They kept everybody really at arm's length because they were special and they were holy and they were trying to maintain that holiness. But I think if we take that point of view, like, we miss something really important about holiness. And I think you can see it in several different places, but let's consider a passage together and think about holiness in this context in 1 Peter, the second chapter. Because the New Testament tells us a lot about what we are and what it is that we are supposed to be. And 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9 tells us something that is very familiar to us. He says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, right? A people for his own possession." And so this is just one of the many places where it's intimated to us that we also are that holy people, like the Israelites were holy. He said to them, "You be holy because I am holy." And we get that same mandate and that same message. But we're created that way for a reason, and he gives the reason. "That you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." So we can't wall ourselves up. We can't wall ourselves up, and we may want to do that to try to keep the darkness at arm's length, and that certainly is part of that concept of holiness that we read about. But we need to be out there, right, cleansing the world around us, being that source of water that comes out. We are the temple now. The water comes out of us, right? And it flows out into the world, and it's not our own water. It's not anything that I do. It's God's word that flows out of me and touches the world around us. And I think that that part of the image is really beautiful and perhaps underappreciated when we start thinking about it, about what true holiness really means. So I hope that something in there was helpful for you, at least interesting. I found it pretty interesting to connect a lot of those passages that I hadn't thought about. But it's at least this time that we give an invitation to those who are not Christians. We always want to provide that opportunity for you to make that choice, to become baptized. And if you are a Christian, then we also give you an opportunity to make your needs known. We're a big group, and you know, we all might have different needs at different times, and we always want to give you the opportunity to speak whenever you have something on your heart and you need help, the help of your brethren. So if we can help you in any way, we encourage you to make those needs known now while we stand and sing.